from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about mass extinctions. There have been 5 of these in the history of the planet so far. In his book, the science writer Peter Brannan explains how life on Earth was broiled or frozen or blasted from space. And it's fascinating to hear what kind of freaky creatures and weird plant life was thriving until it was taken out. Brannan wants to know what these extinctions can teach us about what's happening now, because the common denominator in all of them, climate change. We'll be right back.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join The Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So over the last 500 million years, there have been 5 times when animal life has all but been destroyed on this planet. Not completely, of course. The fact that you're listening to the radio right now is good proof that because there are some stragglers who survived, our ancient ancestors, of course, were among them. But 5 times there was a mass extinction event, the latest 66 million years ago. Explores these events, the volcanic eruptions, the ice ages, the cosmic collisions. Brannan says the Earth's deep past has some frightening echoes of our own condition right now. Climate scientists tell us we're seeing changes we haven't seen for tens, maybe hundreds of millions of years. And he says, we know that when the climate changes or the ocean chemistry is altered, the result has always been devastating for life. Today in the program, Peter Brannan is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Ends of the World. Peter Brannan's writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, The Washington Post. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Peter Brannan, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with your own – it's interesting, your own interest in mass extinctions, which goes back to when you were a kid and you had this fondness for dinosaurs. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was it about dinosaurs that – I guess this is kind of obvious, but that got you thinking about these extinction events?
Well, yeah, I think like most kids, I was certainly when the Jurassic Park book and movie came out, that sort of just fired my imagination. But I think the reason why I'm kind of always been obsessed with these past periods in Earth's history is it sort of itches the same part of my brain that science fiction does. It requires you to imagine these entire worlds that don't exist anymore. And you know, as we progress in paleontological research, we're able to paint these pictures in much more richer detail. And so I think that sort of has a lot to do with at least my childhood interest in it. As I got older, though, and as I was a science reporter, for one thing, I noticed that, you know, sort of in the public imagination, there's this idea of mass extinctions are these things that happen when asteroids hit the planet. Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of that is due to, you know, the movies that came out in the 90s, like Deep Impact and Armageddon. But I had noticed really in the last few decades in the geological community that as geologists had gone back to these older mass extinctions to see if they were caused by asteroids, they really couldn't find much evidence for impacts. And instead, it's sort of been, as you mentioned, these the other mass extinctions are associated with these really extreme climate changes. It actually isn't the case that every time, you know, climate has changed, there have been a mass extinctions, but certainly in the worst mass extinction of all time and some of the others, you do see these really dramatic shifts and, you know, extreme warming and things like that. So I thought that was a story that was both it had been told to some extent, but I wanted to sort of amplify that. And I got the chance to hang out with paleontologists and sort of live my childhood dream.
Yeah,
so
it
was a good deal for me.
You talk about how you came to this I think you describe it as a central revelation as you started to, you know, dig into the story. And that is that, as you put it, forgotten worlds are everywhere, hiding in plain sight. Like, so fossils, magnificent fossils we can find in the Utah deserts. But you don't think about, as you say, the Walmart parking lot or the edge of a baseball diamond.
Right, yeah. So you guys are super lucky out there in Utah where it's just a geological wonderland everywhere you look. But I grew up in New England where you know, everything's covered by trees, and or as one paleontologist put it, he derides the whole East Coast as being covered in photosynthetic glop, which means trees and plants and things like that.
Right.
And civilization and things like this that sort of cover up the rocks underneath. But it's not that once you go east of the Mississippi, the fossils get any less amazing. It's just that they're harder to find because they're not exposed, at the surface like they are there in Utah. But yeah, my reporting brought me to places I never knew there were. Like Cincinnati is one of the most fossil-rich regions in the world, which came as a surprise to me because my dad's family's from Cincinnati. But you go there and you drive on the highway and you look out your window and just falling out of the road cuts are this seafloor from 445 million years ago when these big crazy squid-like things and giant cone shells were sort of the top predators, and it's called the sea without fish. Yeah. There were fish, but they weren't really that important. It's sort of this totally alien world, sort of this bug sea world.
Yeah. We'll get back right to that, by the way, because it's fascinating hearing about what that might have been like. But it's everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wanted to inspire people that, if you just look up what the rock is under your feet, you're going to find an amazing story.
Yeah. So you mentioned that our ability to kind of grasp what these mass extinctions have been like kind of eludes our imagination. For one really important reason is that it's hard for humans, I mentioned this earlier in the introduction, to grasp what it means to go back, anywhere past like a couple thousand years. It's hard for us to imagine it. You say there's this disorienting perspective that geologists operate under. I mean, they have millions of years run together for them. And in order for us to really understand it, we kind of have to switch our brains into that mode. And one of the ways that you help us do that is this kind of analogy. And this is a section I want to have you read from the book. Set this up for us, because I think this helps give us the right perspective, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So I think I wanted to drive home sort of that, we all have this idea that distances in space are these mind-blowing things, but there's this equally fascinating idea of deep time, which is just as humbling and sort of makes you feel sort of infinitesimal. Just time goes back really, really far on this planet. And geologists have all sorts of mnemonics for thinking about deep time. And I took one from this guy, Robert Hazen, at the Carnegie Institution. But you'll hear, if you hang out with geologists, some will compare life history to a glass of beer, where sort of the foamy head is all of animal life, basically. But I use this one, and I could, do you want me to, I can read it right
Yeah,
now.
Would you please? Yeah.
Okay. So the analogy is that each footstep you take is 100 years. Going back in time. So, all right, so this is the excerpt. Let's begin our walk. We'll start in the present and head back. As you lift up your heel, there's no internet. One third of the Earth's coral reefs reappear. Atomic bombs violently reassemble. Two world wars are fought in reverse. The electric glow on the night side of the planet is extinguished, and when your foot lands, the Ottoman Empire exists. One step. After 20 steps, you stroll by Jesus. A few paces later, the other great religions begin to wink out of existence. First Buddhism, then Zoroastrianism, then Judaism, then Hinduism. With each footfall, the cultural milestones get more staggering. The first legal systems and writing disappear, and then tragically, so does beer. After only a few dozen steps, before you can even reach the end of the block, all of recorded history peters out, all of human civilization is behind you, and woolly mammoths exist. That was easy. You stretch your legs and prepare for what couldn't be much longer of a walk. Perhaps it's a short stroll to the dinosaurs and a little farther still to the trilobites. No doubt you'll be at the formation of the Earth by sundown. Not so. In fact, you would have to keep walking for 20 miles a day, every day, for 4 years to cover the rest of the planet's history. Clearly, the story of planet Earth is not the story of Homo sapiens.
Why is that important to keep that in mind, do you think?
Well, I think, as you said in the intro, sort of our conception of history goes back to a few centuries or so, usually, when you learn history in classes. And it's amazing how little the emphasis is put on the rest of the entire history of our planet, especially considering the ways it still influences us today. Mm-hmm. The reason why, Saudi Arabia is an important world player is because there was an ocean there in the Jurassic and the Cretaceous that buried a bunch of sea life. And there's all sorts of ways that geology continues to influence us today. The natural gas we frack in Pennsylvania and New York is from the mass extinctions of the Devonian that sort of pulsed throughout the Devonian when these seas went anoxic and buried a lot of sea life that now we dig up and we burn as natural gas. So it's not just, going to natural history museums and looking at old skeletons. There's geology influences almost everything the way our world works today. So learning about these ancient epochs. And the other important thing is sort of to start thinking about ourselves and our species and as part of this longer geological story. I think sometimes we have trouble thinking past even, the next election. But if we want to endure on this planet for anything approaching geological time, we need to start thinking in sort of these larger deep time perspectives.
Tell us where we are now. Our current carbon dioxide concentration, is it about 400 parts per million? Put that in perspective with the rest of the Earth's history.
So I think the last time we were at 400 parts per million was, the Pliocene. And I think sea level, I might be wrong about this, but I think sea level was something like 30 meters higher than it is today. And
three million years ago, right?
Yeah, that was 3 million years ago. Right. Sorry, but there are projections that by the end of the century, and under sort of a business as usual scenario, we'll get to 1,000 parts per million CO2, which is it's completely crazy from an Earth history perspective because the last time it was that warm was. There's actually a paper out from some Dartmouth paleoclimatologists saying that the early Eocene looks like it was less than 1,000 parts per million CO2. And the early Eocene was a time about 50 million years ago when there were palm trees in Alaska and crocodiles in the Arctic Circle. Yeah. And we have a pretty good understanding now that CO2 in the atmosphere has been the main driver of climate for the last 60 million years at least. When it's been really warm in the Eocene, CO2 is extremely high, and it's sort of dwindled to this point where now we're kind of in an interglacial climate between this larger ice age. But if we bring it back up to 1,000 parts per million or something crazy like that, there's no reason to expect we wouldn't sort of launch ourselves back into a pretty ancient climate that hasn't been seen on this planet for a really long time. So you'll hear people say something like, the Earth's been warmer and life has been happier. And that's true, but it's a totally different planet than what we're living on now.
You talked to a paleontologist from Columbia, Paul Olson. He's one of a number of really great characters in the book, the paleontologist that you talk to. Does Olson think we're at the beginning of a mass extinction?
He does. He thinks that the beginning actually, though, was tens of thousands of years ago.
Right.
Because when humans there's sort of this eerie shadow that whenever humans show up in a new landmass, all the big sort of tasty animals tend to go extinct. So 50 to 60,000 years ago, humans show up in Australia, and not much longer after that, everything on the continent, more than 100 kilograms, goes extinct. So these marsupial lions and giant wombats, these things that would have been the size of, cows, and the giant monitor lizards, all these things kind of go extinct. And then 12,000 years ago, humans show up in North America, and pretty soon we lose all of what we think of as our Ice Age megafauna. Right. Mastodons, mammoths, camels, things like that. And then you bring that up to the present, and now we're really, really influencing the environment in a really major, serious way where we've converted half the planet's land to farmland and done all sorts of, overfishing, all the habitat destruction, all this stuff. So he thinks that if we are in one, it might be like one of these old events where, in the ancient mass extinctions, some of them seem to play out over tens of thousands of years, and maybe ours just started a long time ago. But not every paleontologist you talk to thinks that we necessarily will be at the same level of these events, because these are really extreme outliers in Earth's history when things get just as bad as they possibly could have gotten. And so hopefully the idea is that we still have time to avert, a really crazy catastrophe.
Yeah, Olson says that the industrial spread of the industrial age, the spread of humans, was just the coup de grace for all of this, which kind of raises a lot of questions for me. Mm-hmm. Like, will this mass extinction, would it have happened anyway? Climate change deniers often bring this up, that we're headed for some sort of natural trajectory anyway. So we started burning fossil fuels, and that maybe accelerated things. But were we headed in a certain direction anyway? You know what I mean?
We're headed in the opposite direction. So 2.6 million years ago, we went into the Pleistocene Ice Age, where you have these just massive ice sheets over North America, where you know, Montreal is covered by a mile of ice and Boston's covered by a half mile or something like that. And then every, you know, those last for 100,000 years, and then you go into a few thousand years of this warm interglacial where the ice retreats to the poles, and then that ends, and then you go back into a deep ice age. And there have actually been dozens of glacial advances and retreats, and we're kind of just in the middle of a retreat. We're in what's known as an interglacial period right now, where the ice age ended only a few thousand years ago, and if it wasn't for us, we might be going back into one in the few thousand years. So that, I mean, that doesn't seem like a great prospect. But the opposite idea, that we could launch ourselves into a, you know, the greenhouse of the dinosaurs, is kind of not any better of an alternative. So as I was saying, like, if we could start to think of ourselves as a species in like a long-term geological sense, maybe we could manage our emissions in a way to stave off the next ice age, but not, you know, just burn it all at once, sort of like we're doing, and sort of launching ourselves into the other direction.
Yeah. Peter Brannon is with us. His book is The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
Book, the science writer Peter Brannon explains how life on Earth was broiled or frozen or smothered or blasted from space. And it's fascinating to hear what kind of freaky creatures and weird plant life was thriving until it got taken out. His book is called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter Brannon is joining us from a studio in New York City. What was the weirdest time before the mass extinction event came? Because, as I mentioned, it was so strange trying to imagine what the Earth was like with these creatures before this extinction event came.
Yeah, I think it's anything in any of the first three. So that take place in the Paleozoic. So when people go to natural history museums and they think about paleontology, they think of the time of dinosaurs, or, you know, the time of mammoths, even later than that.
Yeah. But
the Earth had already been up and running. I mean, complex animal life had already been up and running for hundreds of millions of years before the dinosaurs ever even showed up. And it's these weird worlds of the Paleozoic, which, you know, it was a very different – the ocean would have – the things that made reefs would have looked a lot different. So the first mass extinction takes place when there's basically nothing. The interior of the continents would have looked like, you know, the Mars Curiosity rover feed.
Yeah,
There really wasn't any life on land, and all the action was underwater. And I sort of mentioned it before, but it was sort of this weird world of invertebrates, you know, things without backbones. Mm-hmm. So you had giant sea scorpions, some of which would have been the size of humans, and, you know, 3-foot-long trilobites, these things that sort of look like horseshoe crabs, and these giant nautiloid cephalopods I mentioned before, these sort of squid-like things that are jammed in these giant ice cream cones. I think I described them as in the book.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different world that you just have to sort of imagine.
Can I just, while you're on that point, the cephalopods, because this I found this fascinating. You said maybe the first large cephalopods among the reefs of this era marked the first, as you put it, sparks of subjective awareness, like the beginning of consciousness.
Right. I was definitely taking a little license with that, but right. I kind of went off on a tangent there. But yeah, I mean, today when you it's gotten a lot of press that things like octopuses and cuttlefish sort of have this sort of alien intelligence that developed completely independent of our own. But they they show all sorts of signs of, you know, problem solving, and it seems like there is some sort of the lights are on behind their eyes, just in some very bizarre sort of way that we can't really empathize with too much. But this is before you just had like tiny little jawless fish, and right. really the major things on the planet were these things that are related to octopuses and squid and things. So I sort of speculated that maybe this was when sort of the lights turned on for planet Earth, this was sort of the first time something looked around and really, internalized that, I guess. I don't know.
You mentioned that this was so long ago. Rivers hadn't started to meander yet. Rooting plants wouldn't exist for tens of millions of years. A day would have been something like 20 hours long.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you put it somewhere in the book that there are various different worlds, different incarnations of this world we think of now that has existed in our past.
Yeah, I think people sort of think of evolution as this thing that like slowly our world was built up and there was some weird thing that happened to dinosaurs. But no, the world has really been multiple different, has had many different lives in its lifetime. That, you know, when you look at them and learn about them, it's hard to see what the common thread is, you know, between the fossils that are on the side of the highway and Cincinnati and, you know, what's above ground in Cincinnati. Yeah, it just seems like two totally different planets.
Cincinnati is apt, as we're talking about this particular period, because you met with these explain the dry dredgers that you met
with. Dry dredgers are one of a bunch of different groups in the country, just these amateur fossil hunters. I'm sure there's a bajillion in Utah, but just people who spend their weekends going to, you know, overlooked highway road cuts and digging around and collecting fossils. I was very inspired by sort of this sort of community effort to learn more about the geology around them and the fossils that surrounded them.
Okay, so let's stay with that period because this is interesting. So things are going along pretty well. This is 445 million years ago, and things are going along well. I mean, for 40 million years, you say life is developing. The number of species on the planet triples. Reefs start to develop. Animals start to burrow. And this burrowing we can come back to because I think this is really interesting. But there's this like massive big bang of diversity. And there's some speculation that meteors may have had something to do with kind of electrifying. I mean, it's really fascinating. But then something happens that's extreme. Mm-hmm. What shifts? What changes?
Well, so it's at least the stuff I talk about that's over the Midwest, all that life. And you find this on every continent where there were sort of these shallow continental seas that covered a lot of the continents because sea level was hundreds of feet higher than it is today. And so life sort of loved this shallow environment. And then at the end of the Ordovician, you have this massive ice age where the planets just plunge into this deep glaciation. Africa is part of the supercontinent that is drifting over the South Pole, and suddenly it sort of glaciates. And so that drops sea level by hundreds of feet. So all this shallow habitat where sea life lives is totally destroyed. But that can't explain all of it because you also lose life in sort of the deeper waters as well. And it's thought that, you know, the ice would have changed ocean circulation and the oxygenation of the ocean in certain ways that would have destroyed deep water habitat as well. So just sort of everywhere that everything was happy living gets sort of just turned on its head. And you see this massive mass extinction right after this period, as you were talking about. It's called the Great Ordovician Biodiversification Event. Where life has just sort of exploded. So it's sort of this jarring switch between just life blossoming and then falling off a cliff, really. What's interesting about, at least for me, growing up in sort of hiking in New Hampshire and Maine and things, you'd see rocks with these glacial striations, these sort of like grooved lines on the bedrock. And we know there was a glaciation in Africa at the end of the Ordovician because you see the exact same kind of lines in the middle of the Sahara Desert and middle of Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, that's sort of one of the geological stories that I was trying to tell with this book, that there's just these crazy stories hidden in these rocks that unless you know what you're looking at, you know, they're just kind of mind-blowing. The reason why there was an ice age at the end of the Ordovician is it's thought that CO2 was sort of, in the same way that we've sort of descended into an ice age over the past tens of millions of years, starting 2.6 million years ago. 445 million years ago, it's also thought that CO2 was sort of dwindling to this point where you cross a threshold and suddenly you get plunged into an ice age. And how people explain that drop in CO2 is kind of interesting. There's a few theories that sort of get into some arcane geochemistry, but it's thought that the building of the Appalachians and the tropics at this time would have been a good way of sequestering a lot of CO2 because they would have been eroding away really quickly, which is, interestingly enough, a pretty effective way that the Earth has of sort of shuttling CO2 into the – turning it into limestone and burying it in the bottom of the ocean. So the first mass extinction actually doesn't have much in common with the rest of them. But it's an interesting one.
But why? I mean, because you asked this question yourself. Why is this ice age of that particular time so devastating? And
right.
The modern one, which we're sort of still in –
right.
Hasn't been.
Yeah. Well, one idea is that in the Ordovician, you sort of have these island continents that today we're you know, we take the position of the continents sort of for granted, but we're in this sort of weird position where, you know, the Americas, there's these long coastlines from north to south where if climate changes, things can sort of move up and down. You know, in Africa, you kind of have that too. And in the Ordovician, you had these sort of island continents that when the climate changed, these things couldn't really escape to new environments. And we might be sort of recreating that. We are clearly changing the climate, but we're also doing things like we're breaking up habitat. And, you know, we can see that, you know, plant species and fish and stuff are migrating north today. But if we, you know, if we've broken up the habitat and there aren't corridors for things to migrate, then we could sort of recreate sort of this Ordovician world where things are trapped in these islands even as the climate is changing around them.
Took 5 million years for the planet to recover from that age, that mass extinction. And when it did, you say this in the book, that the hollowed out ecosystem provided new opportunities for survivors to flourish. So in some ways it was not entirely a blank slate, but in evolutionary terms, we shifted, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Well, with all these mass extinctions, the flip side of a mass extinction is sort of a mass radiation where suddenly there's all these opportunities for the survivors to sort of just explode in all sorts of new shapes and ecological niches. And so people think my book is super gloomy, but it's also a book about the Earth's resilience just as much as its vulnerability. By the next mass extinction, you're now in this period called the Age of Fishes. So fish sort of radiate after the Ordovician and sort of take over the oceans. And after every mass extinction, there are opportunities for the lucky ones that just happen to survive to sort of inherit the Earth and, you know, go on and become all sorts of crazy new animals.
I don't think your book is gloomy.
I think from a marketing perspective, it's hard to persuade people that it's not gloomy, but it really isn't once you start reading it. It's more of a book about just sort of how fascinating the ancient Earth is, I think, more than anything.
Absolutely. So let's talk about fascinating stuff. In the book, you take us through these, you know, the hundreds of millions of years in the history of the planet before life appears. And you talk about how, and we were talking about how odd it was and how unrecognizable. You mentioned some of these animal experiments before something finally kicked in. Some worked, some didn't. And I know this is all speculation on some level, but I think it's really fascinating to imagine what some of these animal experiments that didn't quite work. Does the fossil record give us some sense of it?
Oh, you mean like the crazy Cambrian explosion animals?
Exactly.
You know, there's a couple famous ones from the Cambrian. So the Cambrian is before the Cambrian, you're in kind of this weird sluggish world where there are these odd frond-looking things at the bottom of the ocean that don't really do much. And then suddenly at the Cambrian explosion around 543 million years ago, that world is sort of destroyed and you have this huge blossoming of all the animal body plans are invented all at once. And some go in these really bizarre directions. Like there's these famous fossils, Anomalocaris, which it's hard to even describe. Like, I would encourage people to just Google what this thing looks like, because it's so bizarre. When it was first described at a meeting, at a scientific meeting, I think people just started laughing because it wasn't really believable.
Right.
And then there's Opabinia, which is this other thing that has this, you know, this long sort of proboscis coming out of its face, but that then has sort of like teeth at the end of it. It's just totally bizarre. So it sort of seems like Earth, or life, was just, you know, there's a blank slate and it's trying out absolutely every possible thing, you know, idea you can imagine. And some of those things went on to, you know, seed all the life that we know, but a lot of those things sort of hit dead ends. So it's this fascinating period of invention for life when it's sort of going off on all these crazy tangents.
There's this paleontologist at Vanderbilt, Simon Derrick, quote and refer to in the book. He talks about how this mass extinction caused the evolution of new behaviors. And he says it's a powerful analogy for what we're doing today. Like, one behavior responsible for this disruption was burrowing. Would you just sort of dig into that and explain that a little bit more? This was fascinating.
Well, so this actually is not one of the, like, sort of canonical five mass extinctions. This is one that people have started to talk about recently as a mass extinction, so I thought I'd just throw it in there sort of as a bonus. But the world before burrowing was sort of – the seafloor was sort of these just microbial mats that were undisturbed, and – these sort of sluggish creatures I was talking about before sort of liked it that way. Some sort of just hugged the mats and, you know, sucked up the nutrients from it. But then once animal life started burrowing into it, they just totally destroyed this microbial mat world, and were sort of these ecosystem engineers where they made the, you know, ecosystem around them more favorable to their own liking. And so he compares it sort of the same way that, you know, and they totally reorganize, like, ocean chemistry. They bury organic carbon. The seas sort of get clearer, which makes it harder for these frond things to just suck up nutrients over their membranes. And so humans are sort of redesigning the world to our own liking as well. And just like the sort of all these weird – this weird world that came before, you know, we're kind of doing it at the expense of the environment and all sorts of other life around us. There's endless ways that humans are sort of changing the planet. I mean, in sort of a interesting, similar way, we are borrowing on a just completely outrageous scale. We're building, you know, gold mines that go 2 miles deep into the earth. And, you know, that sort of thing will be seen in the geological record, like 100 million years from now. But we're also changing the chemistry of the oceans and the atmosphere. You know, we're acidifying the oceans. We're dumping tons of nitrogen and phosphorus into the oceans that's causing these big algae blooms that's using up the oxygen. And, you know, so the humans are also ecosystem engineers in the same way. And I think it's an open question whether the result will be the same as it was sort of for these first animals. I think the optimistic way to look at it would be that the Cambrian explosion sort of was this beginning of this crazy period that we still are in, the age of animals.
Yeah.
And maybe we're at the beginning of some crazy new technological age that will last for 100 million years and be just as different from the age of animals as the age of bacteria was. That might actually sound kind of terrifying, but I think some futurists sort of look at the coming age as this sort of utopian new world. The flip side would be maybe we're just going to cause a mass extinction and, you know, wipe ourselves out in the process. So I don't know.
So we have to talk about the most famous mass extinction, of course. This was 66 million years ago. The end, what is it, Cretaceous? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yep.
Mass extinction. This is the one, of course, that killed off all of the non-bird. You're pretty clear about that point. Like, it got the dinosaurs, but not the non-bird ones.
Right.
So we still have dinosaurs in that form here. That's an important point I think you make. This is the one we pay the most attention to, and I guess it makes most sense. They're the most – the dinosaurs are pretty charismatic. That's why we think about that one.
Yeah, they're the ones that sell tickets to natural history museums.
Right.
They're both the most charismatic creatures in the fossil record, you can argue, and they also – you could make the argument that this is sort of the most spectacular mass extinction as well.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest asteroid that we know to have hit the planet in a billion years hits.
6 mile long asteroid.
Yeah, 6 to 10 miles, something like that. There's some debate whether it was an asteroid or a comet, but I think most people would say that it was an asteroid. But weirdly enough, at almost the exact same time, sort of India is turning inside out, and you've also have one of the biggest volcanic events of all time.
Right.
So that is certainly interesting, and people have been trying to tease out the relative impact of either of those things.
Well, because this is how you put it in the book. You say that the dinosaur's final moments were punctuated by the impact of the asteroid, which you don't say caused by necessarily, which gives you the sense that they were either already headed for some sort of an extinction event, and this asteroid just came along to kind of kill it off, I guess.
Yeah, the one paleontologist sort of derisively calls that the bombing the nursing home scenario, which he doesn't believe in, that sort of dinosaurs were on their way out anyways, which I actually don't think, and I don't think many people would think that's the case. They're definitely, so in these volcanoes in India, they're called the Deccan Traps. They erupted enough lava to cover the lower 48 states in 600 feet of lava. So this is a completely crazy event. And they actually start a few hundred thousand years before the dinosaurs go extinct. So this is why a lot of people would say that they couldn't have caused the extinction. But you do see dramatic climate change right before the asteroid hits. You see ocean acidification, which is what happens when CO2 reacts with seawater. It makes it more acidic and is bad for sea life in general. But there's this interesting new idea that the asteroid sort of kicked the Deccan Traps into overdrive. So as people have gone back to date the lava in India, it seems like the most voluminous period of eruptions is right at the extinction boundary. And it's thought that this is a paper from Mark Richards at UC Berkeley that Walter Alvarez is actually on this paper. He was the one with his dad who discovered the asteroid impact in 1980, or at least published in 1980. That the asteroid might have actually sort of screwed up the planet's it would have been capable of causing earthquakes all over the planet and would have kicked the Deccan Trap sort of in overdrive. And so the asteroid hits in Mexico, which is just this horrific event for all sorts of reasons. And then on the other side of the planet, sort of India explodes. It's been really interesting to see over the last few years of this sort of these stories converging. I think it's still an open question about just how bad either one was. Mm-hmm. And people certainly do debate pretty, with a lot of fervor about this. When you go to meetings, sometimes these talks get pretty contentious. But yeah, it's incredible how much the dinosaurs were up against, basically. And mammals. So this is the worst mass extinction for mammals in their history, too. Right. We think of them as the big winners, but really it's just that, you know, they barely squeak through and all the big guys were gone and they get to sort of radiate and take over the planet.
So what did you learn about this so-called Anthropocene, that we're in the beginning of the sixth mass extinction? Doug Irwin was one of the paleontologists you asked about this. He's pretty skeptical about the idea.
Yeah. So in the past few centuries, humans have driven less than 1% of species extinct. And in some of these mass extinctions, you're talking about, you know, over 90% of species that have been driven extinct. So I think the good news is that we're not there yet. And Doug would just sort of argue that, that these mass extinctions, while we are going through an ecological crisis now, he thinks that, it's sort of inaccurate to compare us to these events when the planet's almost sterilized, because certainly we still have a ton of biodiversity around us. The frightening thing is that, a lot of species their range sizes are contracting and their population numbers are going down, which is sort of the first step on the road to extinction. And sort of the most famous paper that's been written about this is, or the most widely, I think the best paper that's been written about this is by this guy, Anthony Barnosky at University of California, who wrote, "Has the Sixth Mass Extinction Arrived?" And he says that we haven't reached the levels of the Big Five yet, but if we keep it up for a few centuries to millennia, then we could get there, but we don't know when there are tipping points along the way. So this is Doug's thing, where it could sort of be that the ecosystem looks like it's taking a beating, things are sort of degrading a little bit, but it's hanging in there. But then you pass this tipping point when sort of it's, you know, a house of cards collapses, could unfold like a power grid failure where, you know, you get just one software bug in a control room in Ohio and the whole thing goes dark. So these mass extinctions might sort of happen as these big network collapses, and we don't know where that is. So we're not there yet, which is the good news, but we don't really know where the line is that we're edging up to. So rather than, I think, so this, that part was excerpted, and I think a lot of conservation biologists were upset by it because they thought I was downplaying the fact that we're not in a mass extinction yet. But it was actually a greater call for like conservation, because we don't know where the edge is that we're walking up to.
Yeah, well, you say inching up to a mass extinction might be a little like inching up to the event horizon of a black hole. Once you go over a certain line, you say a line that perhaps doesn't even appear all that remarkable. Once you get there, pretty much all is lost. I mean, that was the sort of your final point about that.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. And there's a pretty scary paper from this guy at MIT a few weeks ago saying that we only have 300 gigatons of carbon dioxide to burn before we sort of will put the Earth's oceans into a mass extinction mode. And 300 gigatons is less than, you know, they say that we can burn to meet the Paris climate goals. So it's not much more. I don't know if, I mean, that's just one paper, but certainly there's indications that we need to pretty quickly change our behavior on a massive scale to avoid some pretty grisly outcomes.
So in the end of the book, you imagine what it would be like on Earth hundreds of millions of years in the future. And as you point out, not much of our existence is going to leave all that much of a trace. What is the image of all of this? You say the world map, of course, is unrecognizable, probably the creatures. What are you imagining 800 million years hence?
I don't really know what it will look like. I know some people think that the Atlantic Ocean is going to get destroyed and we'll sort of be back in a Pangea.
Yeah.
Other people would say that that's going to happen over the North Pole. So the continents are going to look totally different than they do today. CO2 will be running out by then. So we think of CO2 today as this sort of boogeyman, but, you know, plant life requires it. And in the long run, the planet is sort of, as the sun gets brighter, there's reasons that CO2 would sort of decline in the long term. And so that might kill plant life. And
Here's what you write. You say the planet will become increasingly shrubby, barren, and brown until about 800 million years from now, when carbon dioxide will drop below 10 parts per million. When this happens, photosynthesis and thus plant life will become impossible.
Yeah, and that's from a paper, I think it's called Future Causes of Mass Extinctions or something like that. But it's also going to be getting really hot by then because the sun's just going to be getting really bright. But, you know, rather than dwell on that eventual sort of miserable end, that means we still have hundreds of millions of years where presumably we are, you know, maybe a little less than halfway through this amazing period of complex life on the planet.
Well, that's where you come back around, Peter, and you say squandering our good fortune would be a civilizational failing and possibly a cosmologically important failing too. Yes, it seems grim, and yes, this is where we're headed, but it seems like the message that you're making is, look, we still have time here, and we need to do something, I guess.
Yeah, I think we need to mature as a species if we want to endure for geological time or anything like it. And I talked to a cosmologist at the end of the book who sort of has hopes for this sort of grand Star Trek vision for humanity where we'll go on to colonize the galaxy and all this other stuff. But that could be foreclosed by us just being stupid in the next few decades. And we really are at this really make or break moment for the species and for the planet where, you know, if we get our act together, maybe there's this bright, beautiful future that will go on for a long time. Or, you know, we'll just be another, you know, you'll go to some geologist in 100 million years from who knows what branch of the tree of life will go to some canyon and just see, oh, there was this weird time at the end of the Pleistocene where there was this mass extinction. And then who knows what happened after that. But, you know, so I think geology does a lot to impress upon you that you're, you know, just like studying astronomy, that, you know, you're really small in the big picture. But it's also sort of amazing that humans have the capability in the next few decades to make decisions about how we run our civilization that will, you know, endure in the geological record for hundreds of millions of years. So we actually are important in the big picture, and I think we should recognize that.
It's one of the things you mentioned, that there's this sentiment out there that you hear that, you know, we are these puny humans who represent just a teeny fraction of the experience on life on Earth, and so it's hubris, really, to see that, to say that we have much of an effect. But say something about that, because you say in the book that really is a misunderstanding of the history of life, to have that kind of idea.
Yeah, I mean, there have been small, or not even, well, so sometimes you hear that we're the only species ever that is like single-handedly caused mass extinction. There's actually, you could say there's this major mass extinction at the end of the Devonian where you have an ice age, and that's presumably caused by the evolution of trees. So that's a, there's a type of life that sort of took over the continents and sucked up a lot of CO2 and caused an ice age. And sometimes you see life can cause these changes in the chemistry of the planet that are really reorganize everything. So the burrowers that you talked about at the beginning, it's strange to think of things like burrowing worms having a major effect on the planet, but they totally reorganize the oceans and maybe help cause this mass extinction. So for us, as this global society of 7 billion people who are digging as much ancient carbon out of the ground and putting in the atmosphere as fast as possible and spreading out all over the planet and changing the planet in all these important ways, to say that, oh, we're not that important on the planet is, I don't quite understand that outlook.
Do you feel optimistic, or do you feel pessimistic after having looked at this deep history of the planet?
So there's ways in which I'm more optimistic and ways in which I'm less optimistic. One is that what I was talking about before, the fact that we still have time to avert, that we're not the Permian mass extinction, this time when basically it's the planet's all is lost moment. You lose trees in the fossil record for 10 million years. Coral reefs are replaced by bacterial slime, and just it's absolutely as bleak as it gets. We're not there yet, and that's the good news. And the other thing I'm optimistic about, and I don't know if this is consolation to most people, but I sort of went into this project thinking, oh, we're, you know, humans are going to bring the whole thing down with us. And, you know, we're not. And in the long run, the planet's going to be just fine. If it's any consolation, in 10 million years, things are going to be fine. But yeah, certainly in the next few decades, things could get pretty uncomfortable for us. But I also think people conflate the collapse of civilization with a mass extinction. So I think things could get really, really miserable for, you know, the mass migration and all these sorts of stresses that we're seeing today could get worse. But whether that doesn't have much to do with mass extinction. And we have time to, I think we have time to avert both that, both the, you know, these stresses of that we're inflicting on our own life and reducing our quality of life. But also we have time to avert, you know, this, the biological mass extinction as well. So I would say I'm optimistic, but it's tough to read the headlines today and or any day of the week and sort of be too get too happy.
You get really personal in the book. Toward the end, you write about the loss of your mother. And as you're writing about the mortality of the planet, your mother was dying. And I don't know, do you want to say something about that, how your mother's last insights really gave you a sense that that all could be well, I think, is that how you put it?
Yeah. So I think it's sort of in line with what I've been talking about, where the study of mass extinctions is both this really – it can get kind of to be a grim topic, but it's also teaches you so much about the resilience of life on Earth as well. And, you know, I was also – so it's sort of a – I don't know, a topic that has both sides of the coin. And I was going through this really, you know, traumatic, you know, heartache and episode in my life. And I was getting sort of this gloomy outlook on life. And my mom was really, she would, like her refrain was all will be well. And I just didn't understand how she could say that given what she was going through and everything. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I sort of feel like that about the planet as a whole, that we're going through all this ecological and civilizational strife, but I don't know. There's something about that refrain of just all will be well that in the long run, the earth will be okay. And yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. It's hard to put into words what that was like going through that at the same time that you're sort of learning about all these other traumatic events. So it's quite the experience putting this book together.
Peter Brannon, this book is The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Peter, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.